Good to see you all here. Tonight, we're going to talk about the Brahma Viharas. How many of you are new meditators? By that, I mean like less than a year. Okay. So the reason I ask that is to know, you know, where to kind of gear my talk about the Brahma Viharas. So the Brahma Viharas are called the divine abodes. So it's Pali, meaning divine abode. And they're really attitudes. They're ways of being. And so they have to do primarily with how we present ourselves, both to ourselves and to others. And I like to think of them as kindness practices. Now that you've been practicing meditation for a while, mindfulness, you're probably noticing things that come up for you all the time. You know, ways that seem to be the way you feel about yourself, right? Sometimes when I sit, I notice that all I can think about is judgment. Self-judgment. Oh, why did I do that? I should have done something different. Oh, if I was only better, why can't I be a little more equanimous? How come I always react that way? And so there are all these states of mind that come up when we're sitting that have to do with the ways that we look at ourselves. So tonight we're going to spend some time talking about how to influence those mind states. So, you know, the thoughts come and go. We don't have to react in a certain way, but we tend to have habitual patterns. And so maybe there are ways that we can influence what comes up in our minds. And the way that we're going to talk about doing that is really through the use of mindfulness. So the Brahma Vihara practices are practices that soften the heart but strengthen the mind. And that's why they're interesting to practice. We're not going to talk too much about the different practices. We're going to just talk about what they are and what their values to us are and how we might use them. So an abode is a house, right? It's a place to be, a place to stand. And all of these things have to do with where we are. They're called divine abodes because they represent an ideal. Something that is an ideal way of interacting with ourselves and with others. I want to start with a poem you may have read before or heard before, but it seems particularly applicable to what we're going to talk about. It's called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of a road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Then it goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. That's the idea of the Brahmaviharas. Practices that help us to adopt this way as being our natural state, our natural abode, our place of standing. So there are four Brahmaviharas. They are metta, or loving kindness. This has to do with loving kindness displayed toward the people around you and yourself. The second is karuna, compassion. This has to do with a special kindness shown to those who suffer, which includes ourselves. Mudita, which is sympathetic joy. This has to do with celebrating the good fortune of others without envy. And the fourth is upekkha, or equanimity. This has to do with balance, and it's basically being able to accept what is. So those are the four: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. They deal primarily with relationship. They're not in isolation. It's the way that we are with ourselves and with others. It has to do with being fully present and facing whatever our fears are. Because until we recognize those fears, we can't be kind to ourselves. We don't even know what we're being kind about. So when we meet someone we don't like, what happens? There are things that come into our minds. How do we interact with people that we don't like? Do we avoid them? Do we push them away? What's the style that we have? Suppose someone does something to us that's really hurtful. What do we do then? How does it feel when someone treats you in a way that is truly unfair? What happens inside of you? How does that feel in your mind, in your heart? Can our hearts stay open when someone is hurtful to us? And what does that mean to stay open when someone's hurtful to us? It doesn't mean that we need to condone something that is unwholesome. It doesn't mean that we have to stand in place and let someone hit us in the head. It only means that we have to control the way that we react to them. The path of kindness is about controlling our reactivity to what happens, so that we have some freedom in what happens and we don't just react. Do we have a bent? I have a bent toward judgment. I won't even ask the question. I tend to be very judgmental. And so it's something I have to work with a lot. I notice myself making judgments as opposed to discernments. You know, it's where a judgment is, I say this is good or bad. A discernment is, it's different, and I choose between those differences, if that makes any sense to you. Sometimes we can get stuck on self-judgment. Oh, why did I do that? You should have seen me the other day. I got a speeding ticket. Ouch. I felt so stupid. And then I thought, it was just a speeding ticket. You know, I have to pay the ticket. I could also spend a lot of time beating myself up about it, but that's just making it more expensive. So what do you do when you see someone begging in the street? And this person is a little unsavory and maybe you're a little afraid of them. How do you feel? Are you scared? Are you fearful? Are you angry? What's this person doing here? Do you feel guilty? These are all ways we have to know what these feelings are in order to be able to discern other ways of being. They're all common reactions, but they are just that. They are reactions. A lot of the mental tendencies that we have are really rooted in our not being kind to ourselves or to others, are not understanding what's really happening. I remember talking to Paul Haller one time. He's the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. And I had just come out of a meeting where everyone was pretty much beating up on me because I had done something that some people felt was unfair. I didn't invite them to an event I didn't know they wanted to go to. And I said, oh, it's just horrible. People were beating up on me. I wish I'd never done that. And he said, you know, I think it's a good idea to make it a fair fight. Don't beat up on yourself. Let them do it. And I thought, you know, that's pretty interesting. Not a bad suggestion. You know, there's no point in adding to that grief and suffering. So is it possible to train our minds to be otherwise than reactionary? And how can we train our minds to be more kind? What we want to do is get to the point where the practices of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity arise spontaneously. So it doesn't become a case of, I should be doing this, or we criticize ourselves because we're not doing this, but they just arise as a natural condition of having gotten used to it, where it becomes our mind habit. So that's what we want to do, is develop a mind habit that allows those things to arise naturally when we're in a particular situation. So I'll give you an example of something that happened to me recently. There was, and this is coming up in several ways, I have to admit, it's really writing on my mind. So there was an event that occurred, and I wrote a letter saying, this is the way we feel. We want this to be, there was a group that I belonged to, and the group had become very fractious, and people were arguing with each other. It didn't matter. Always there was an argument. And it became so unpleasant to be in this environment where there was just always an argument that those of us who were responsible for the group getting together wrote a letter and said, we want to have a place where kindness is the environment that we operate in, and that's not what's happening here. So we understand that there are different ways of interacting, and you're welcome to take this and go elsewhere with it, but here we're going to treat each other kindly. Well, so the letter went out over my signature, and a woman came up and she told me how much she hated this letter. She was really angry about this letter, and I could feel the resentment rising in me, and the energy was rising, and I was getting ready to defend myself and say, see, 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 see. And instead what happened is I thought, well, she probably is feeling very threatened. And so I stopped and I said, was there anything in the letter that you thought was good? And she said, well, there probably was, but I just disagree with the letter. But by the time we'd gotten to that place, I no longer was in that place where I was ready to go out and do battle. You know, the adrenaline had kind of gone down, and I just let it pass. It turned out I didn't have to argue with her, and I didn't have to defend myself. So what's happening in this is it started both with mindfulness and with an intention. So first I had to notice that I was getting riled, and that I was about to lash out and do whatever was going to come next. But also, I had the intention of being kind. That's what the letter was about. It was, this is how we want to react. So if I'm going to then immediately jump into arguing with her, then, you know, I've lost my case. So that's what we're talking about, is trying to do that. And the way that we do that, the way that we get to the point where that becomes spontaneous, is that's where we put our minds. We think about how we're going to behave. We have to know how we're behaving now. We have to know what it feels like to be kind. We have to know what it feels like when we're not being kind. The Buddha said, what a person considers and reflects upon for a long time, to that his mind will bend and incline. So unless we know, we're never going to be that way. There's a way of being, there's a philosopher who said a good way of adopting new characteristics is to pretend you have them. And what happens is you tend to develop them. It's quite remarkable. So let's talk about these four. The first is metta, or loving kindness. This is wishing well for ourselves or for others. It's really simple, wishing well. It's possible to be angry with someone and still wish them well. But it's not necessarily easy. And it has a lot to do with accepting ourselves. Kindness to ourselves has a lot to do with accepting ourselves. It has to be motivated, this loving kindness, this wishing well for others, has to be motivated by something within us that wants to be, by a favorable intention. It can't be motivated by fear or aversion. I'll give you some examples of those in a moment. Metta has been likened to a soft rain that penetrates the heart and softens it, relaxing our defense mechanisms. You know, that's what it is, those defense mechanisms that get us going. It's been compared to the relationship between a mother and her child. When a mother first bonds with her child, she'll do anything for that child. Wishes that child everything in the world that is the most wonderful. That's the feeling of loving kindness. We're going to do a practice around that in a little while, but I think I'm going to leave it for a moment. When I talk about loving kindness, it's not a mushy feeling good thing. It has a lot of energy and strength. Today I was talking to a woman whose brother-in-law has developed cancer. And her husband, who is the older brother, is really distraught because he can't seem to convince his brother to do certain things. So his brother has esophageal cancer and he's smoked all his life. So he wants him to not smoke and eat well, and he's giving him all of these instructions, and he can't understand why his brother doesn't accept his help. He keeps saying, leave me alone, go away, I don't want to hear from you. And I said, you know, what his brother wants is for his brother to say to him, I'm here for you no matter what. An important part of loving kindness is the fact of being unconditional. It can't be, I'm going to give you love if you love me back. I'm going to give you love if you do what I tell you to do. I'm going to give you love if I get my outcome. It has to be totally unconditional. I love you even if you disagree with everything I said. Right? It's that feeling of acceptance to the other person. When I first started practicing meditation, I actually began with loving kindness meditation. It was kind of the luck of the draw at the time, but I was very depressed, very seriously depressed. And I sat, and what in the practice of loving kindness meditation, what you do is you wish well for yourself and for others. You say a series of phrases and you repeat them over and over again. And you always start with yourself. So that's what I was doing. I was wishing myself well. So I would sit for an hour and just say these phrases to myself over and over again. I never actually got past myself. I was so needy. I kept saying, there's got to be something. And it felt specious. You know, it felt like there was something wrong with it, but I just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And then one day, I was completely overwhelmed. Just completely overwhelmed. Everything changed. And what happened is I realized I had done the best I could do. That all these things I was beating myself up about were ways that I was trying to convince myself I needed to be. But that I actually was doing the best I could do. And I started crying. And I was crying because this practice of continually wishing myself well caused me to really develop a compassionate, care for myself. I really cared for myself, and that was such a beautiful thing to realize. I cared about myself. I could stop beating up on me. And it was unconditional. It was accepting who I was. That's a very important part of it. So we wish well for others, we wish well for ourselves, and it has to do with really accepting the way things are. Now, each of these qualities has a near enemy and a far enemy. So loving kindness is wishing well. The near enemy of loving kindness is selfish affection. That has to do with something that has hooks connected to it, you know. That's the I love you if you love me back. I love you. I'm going to offer this to you if I get what I want. So that's the unconditional part. So the near enemy is selfish, holding on, clinging kind of loving kindness. The far enemy is ill will. That's where we actually wish ill will. Like, oh, I hope you trip over that, right? I mean, we've all had those feelings, right? That is the opposite of loving kindness, where we actually wish something bad to happen. There are lots of ways for that to happen. It can be a cutting comment. It can be a put down. I've known some perfect squelches I've wanted to use. You know, I have exactly the right thing, but it's not where my heart wants to go. The second quality of kindness is karuna, or compassion, empathy, compassion. So this has to do with accepting seeing the suffering of others and wishing to help relieve the suffering of others. That's compassion. The first thing we have to do with compassion is actually allow it into our experience. So compassion is not saying, oh, that thing over there is really bad, I feel really bad about it. No, it's that thing right here next to me, where we put ourselves into that very experience. Compassion is spoken of as a quivering in the heart. You can literally feel it. You know, there's a kind of movement in your chest, and you're thinking, oh. It has to be distinguished from sadness and grief. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. It's really a sense of interconnectedness, of mercy. Compassion has to do with not having separation between you and the other, but really a unity. It means willing to bear the burdens of another. You can't bear them if you're pushing them off to the side. They have to be part of you. It's listening for the cries of help and being available for them. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Now, the thing about pity is that it really has a feeling of superiority to it. You know, when you feel pity towards someone, you say, oh, that poor person. But they're really separate from me. It has nothing to do with me. That's them over there. There's a distancing that happens, and it's as if we're trying to protect ourselves from it. When we use some efforts for compassion that have pieces of pity in it, we're kind of implying somehow that there's something wrong about the other person, you know. I'm going to help you because you can't help yourself. As opposed to, I'm going to help you because you could be me. Not, thank God this hasn't happened to me. It's, this could be me. There's just a shade difference. And the difference has to do with the energy that is involved. Right? So there's an energy in all of this. It's not passive. There's real engagement. One of the things that we do in hospice is we make a big point of the fact that sometimes it's not so important what you do as it is that you show up, that you're there, that you witness what's happening, that you're right there with the person accompanying them. It's a very important point. One of the things we do is we celebrate people's birthdays. This is a residential hospice at Laguna Honda in the city, and we always celebrate people's birthdays. So this particular day was Henry's birthday, and Henry was a schizophrenic and alcoholic, and I don't even know what his illness was. I've kind of gotten so that I don't pay much attention to that anymore. But one of the conditions that he had was that his head was sort of bent over forward like this. So you couldn't actually look him in the eye by looking straight at him. You had to kind of look under to look at him. And he'd drool once in a while. But he was a really sweet man. Really sweet man. So it was his birthday, and he was sitting there, and there was somebody new who had organized the birthday. And she had a list of things that had to be done, you know, put out the cake, open the present, do all these things. So everyone had gathered in the common room, and he was sitting there sort of playing with his cake, and it was really great. He had red frosting, and he ended up with red frosting all over himself, and he loved it. He just loved it. Well, this person said, well, open his card, open his card. So I opened the card. And then she said, open his present, open his present. And one of the other residents said, let him open his own present. He can open his present. And I realized that by helping him, we were actually denying him his own experience. It didn't have anything to do with compassion. It was totally different. What happened is he finally did open his own present. And everybody left, and he was still there eating his cake. You know, he was having a party. Everybody else was doing something else. He was quite beautiful. Compassion arises in the spirit of namaste. You've seen people putting their hands together, bowing and saying namaste. Namaste means I bow to the me in you. It's that recognition. So compassion is that connection, that dealing with suffering, because it is my suffering, not just your suffering. It's my suffering. I have another poem I'm going to read, just because I absolutely love this poem. And of course, my sticky has fallen off. Wouldn't you know it? Here it is. This is called The Same Inside. It's by Anna Swear. Walking to your place for a love feast, I saw at a street corner an old beggar woman. I took her hand, kissed her delicate cheek. We talked. She was the same inside as I am, from the same kind. I sensed this instantly, as a dog knows by scent another dog. I gave her money. I could not part from her. After all, one needs someone who is so close. And then I no longer knew why I was walking to your place. I love this poem because it's so beautiful. It says, having met this woman, once I really let her into me, I was totally in love with her. She was no longer the old beggar woman on the street. One of the things I mentioned before is that sorrow and grief are not what compassion is. So in addition to pity as a near enemy, sorrow and grief are near enemies also. The thing about sorrow and grief is they tend to be kind of depressive, right? When you see suffering and you become depressed, you're sort of entering into the suffering, and it's sort of taking you over. It's a very downward feeling. Whereas compassion has energy to it. The other night, this group that I told you about, we finally dissolved the group. And I was sad about it because I had started the group. And there were some other people who were really being helped. And they were sad and they'd been crying. I went home and I was sitting in my chair and I could just feel these waves of sorrow. You know, just my whole body would kind of vibrate in these little tiny movements of sorrow. And I thought, wow, this is really an overreaction, which is what it was. It was an overreaction, but it was real. You know, I was sitting there with the sorrow. And then I got an email from my colleague who had outlined this four-step program. We were going to do this, and we were going to do this, and we were going to do this, and we were going to take care of them this way. And I went, whoa! I wrote him a response, and I said, let's slow down. Nothing has to happen immediately. And all of a sudden, the act of saying, this is what needs to be done, brought my equilibrium back. And I was no longer overcome and overwhelmed by that sadness. I was able to be compassionate about it, you know, concerned about these people, without having it drag me down and you know, sort of bury me into the feeling and the emotion of it. Because it takes a certain amount of buoyancy and energy to carry out the compassion. Compassion's far enemy is cruelty. And we all pretty much know what that is. Cruelty is totally devoid of mercy. It's the force present in all forms of intolerance. We can't see ourselves in the other person, and so we can't show them mercy. The third quality of kindness is mudita, sympathetic joy. And I actually love this one. I love mudita. It's a very fun thing to work with. Sympathetic joy has to do with really rejoicing in someone else's good fortune. First of all, I like rejoicing, and it's nice to have an excuse. Why not? I don't care whose it is. We can rejoice in it anyway. The near enemy of mudita is exuberance. Now, exuberance is a little different because it's kind of an overreaction, and there's a certain desperation about it. Yeah. Oh, boy, I'm so glad you won the lottery! But there's something strained about it, you know? The far enemy of mudita is resentment, envy, jealousy. I can't rejoice in your good fortune because bad things keep happening to me. It involves the comparing mind, and we get lost in that comparing mind. Another way this happens is that people will dampen a victory by pointing out that the competition was weak, right? And they're sort of putting a damper on someone else's joy. That's also part of the resentment, the far enemy of sympathetic joy. There's this house in the region where I live up by Point Reyes National Seashore. It's a really beautiful place to live. And we have a lovely house, you know, sitting there. But down the road from us is this magnificent house. And it has outbuildings, you know. It has slate, carved slate decorations on the outside of the house. It has cherry wood inside. It's a magnificent place. It's truly gorgeous. And when we first moved there, you know, we noticed this house and said, wow. And we started referring to it as the Envy House. And so I was thinking about that, and I thought, oh, God, that doesn't sound good, the Envy House. So I said, you know, we really ought to call it the Mudita House. And my husband said, Mudita House? I said, yeah, you know, let's just rejoice that they have this house. And so we started doing that. We just started calling it the Mudita House. And, you know, we've gotten to the point now where when we walk by this house, we have to introduce all our friends to this house. It's like we own this house as our Mudita House. It's really wonderful. We get a lot of joy out of this house. God knows I don't want the house. But there's that initial sort of craving. Oh, that's so beautiful. You know, I really like that. But what we've discovered by just calling it our mudita house is that we don't have to have it. And we can still enjoy it. And that's the spirit of mudita, you know. Sympathetic joy. Oh, this is wonderful. How wonderful. The fourth quality is upekkha, mental equilibrium, balance. And upekkha actually it's translated as kind of, it's discerning rightly, viewing justly. You know, there's a certain accuracy about it. It's an unshakable balance of mind. Unshakable balance. Right? You can hit my hand, it comes right to the same place. That's equanimity. Whatever comes, to be able to hold whatever comes. It's really about acceptance. It's about not reacting. It's about being with what is. It's a very spacious place, equanimity. Because you're not putting yourselves into little narrow channels. I have to do this, I have to do this, I can't do that. It's a very spacious place. And it has to do with being able to accept all the changes that keep coming in life. Being in balance is actually a very important part of kindness. Because it doesn't have to do with doing the impossible. It just has to do with seeing what is true. Seeing what is true and saying, ah, this is what's true. Being able to hold that. It's seeing with understanding. So you're not pushing it away. You're not pulling it to yourself. You're just saying, this is what's happening. The near enemy of equanimity is indifference. I don't care. You know, when you start noticing what's going on in your life, you find that there are things that you like, things that you don't like, and things that you're neutral about. So indifference is a little different than neutral. Indifference has a feeling of aversion to it. You know? Indifference says, I don't care about it. Which, you know, there's a charge there. The far enemy of equanimity is craving. I want to change this. I hurt. I've got to change it. I don't like this. I've got to change it. It's working in the world where you realize that there are things that come and go, and sometimes you like them and sometimes you don't like them. And we all have preferences. So it's living in that world where the eight worldly winds, praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, all of these things exist all the time. Equanimity says that we can hold these as they come up because we realize they change. It's not static. They come and go. But as humans, we tend to attach to those things that are pleasant and push away those things that are unpleasant. And the equanimous person sort of holds all of it and says, ah. Ah. Ajahn Chah talks about equanimity, and he says the way to cultivate equanimity is to learn to let go. So if we let go a little, we have a little peace. If we let go a lot, we have a lot of peace. If we let go completely, we have complete peace. It's kind of scary, isn't it? But basically, equanimity says, no matter how I might wish things to be, this is how they are. It doesn't mean we don't care about how they are. It just means that we recognize it. And so we're not buffeted by the changes that occur in life. So I had another story, but I think I'm going to leave it here. Let me just summarize what this is. So we have metta, loving kindness, which embraces all beings. Karuna, compassion, which embraces the sufferings of others. Mudita, sympathetic joy, which embraces others' prosperity and good fortune. And upekkha, equanimity, which embraces the good and the bad, the hot and the cold, the loved and the unloved, the pleasant, the unpleasant. So those are the practices, those are the feelings that we want to engender to be able to live in the world where things are kind, where that's what comes from us. Upekkha, equanimity. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to end with a little loving kindness practice, but I want to open this up to any questions or comments that people might have.
Mm-hmm. a question about the second one, the compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of thinking it through as you're talking, but what if a person tends to take that to an extreme and not practicing metta for oneself? So are you... at the end, you're saying equanimity. So you're supposed to balance all these four practices so that you're giving that compassion to yourself as well as to others and doing it in kind of a circular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can give you an example of that, actually. Last week, I was with the Cancer Help Program, and we had a retreat going. And a friend of mine who was from the Sangha died in over Thanksgiving. And there was a memorial here for her last Tuesday. And I was doing this retreat up in Marin. And I left there and I was driving down. It's about an hour and a half down here. And as I was driving down, I was thinking, oh, why am I doing this? This is really crazy. It's just a memorial service. And, you know, I've got this other thing and I'm going to have to drive back and be back there tonight and then go home. And I realized that I was so tied up with how important it was for me to be helping other people that I wasn't taking care of the fact that I needed to come here and say goodbye to my friend. I mean, it's a perfect example of that. It was inappropriate diligence. It wasn't being kind to myself. It wasn't showing compassion for myself. And if we can't show compassion for ourselves, loving kindness for ourselves, we can't really do it for others either.
So the intention is important as well.
The intention is extremely important.
Doing it based from an ego space to be
right,
helping someone else to have our ego feel good, but the
right
intention.
Why? Now it's very addictive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Thank you for that question. It's a good question. Anything else? Yes.
I'd like to go back to your point about judgment.
Uh-huh.
You talked about your own experience.
Yeah.
You primarily suffered from self-judgment?
Yes. Although, at the time, what actually happened to me was other people judged me. And then I beat myself up in addition to them judging me.
Well, that was my question.
Yeah. I did.
Somebody that you really cared about.
Well, it's arguable whether I cared about them, but yes, it's true. Yeah.
So, were you able to deal with that person and their judgment as well as your own judgment of yourself? Were there any techniques for that?
What I realized, well, there were a lot of steps to it. But one of the other things I realized was that the people who I felt had been, I felt that I had been unjustly judged. You know, I had these flaws, but basically, I got caught in something that wasn't my fault. And so there were some people that I blamed for that happening. And so constituted the people that caused this judgment to come down on me, and they were people that for a long time I couldn't feel any kindness toward. And in the same way that I eventually got to the point where I realized that I was doing the best I could, I've come to believe that they're doing the best they could do also. That is, I no longer ascribe evil intentions to what they did. Does that make any sense? But it didn't happen all in once.
You didn't believe in the fairness of their judgment.
I did not believe in the fairness of their judgment. That's correct. But it didn't change the fact that I continued to make up stories where if I had done X, Y, and Z, it still might not have come down the way it did. Do you see what I mean? You know, if I had, there may be a case where Oh, here, I'll give you a quick example. There was a woman at the cancer retreat last week who was very anxious when she first arrived, and I made a lot of effort to make her feel really comfortable and welcome and so on. And then I was kind of gone on Thursday and Friday of the week, and on Saturday morning, I came up to her and I said, "Oh, I haven't seen you for 2 days. I feel really bad." And she said, "I just wrote on the evaluation form that you were very nice and you've been rejecting me for 2 days." Okay. Now, that was unjust. But it was still her experience that she felt rejected by me, whether it was true or false. So I could have been saying, "Well, that was really stupid." And in fact, I thought just our talking about it had made it okay, but it turned out it wasn't okay. And she called up early this week complaining that I had not treated her fairly. So I called her again. So there are steps, you know. The things that happen that she wasn't malicious and I wasn't malicious. And still there was misunderstanding. So you have to leave space for things to happen. The judgment may be unfair, but from another perspective, it doesn't look so bad. Does that make sense? Is it anywhere in the area you wanted to have your discussion?
More on that idea of judgment by somebody that you really care about and buy into that judgment.
Yeah, well, I think all of us have experiences like my father used to tell me that I was really great. I could do anything I wanted to do. And in the same breath, every time I wasn't perfect, he'd tell me how terrible I was, over and over again. And I kept buying into that cycle with him for a really long time. And to the extent that my relationship with him as an adult was very strained. And so when he was very ill before he died, I went to visit him. And he was afraid to go to sleep because he was afraid he wouldn't wake up again. And so what I did for that whole weekend is I sat with him and I pretended when he fell asleep that he hadn't fallen asleep. So when he woke up, I'd carry on as if we'd been discussing something all along. And in the process of doing that, while I was just sitting there with him and watching how afraid he was, I suddenly realized that I couldn't judge him either, that I had no right to judge him. And that changed everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. It's the same spirit. It has to do with, I bow to the me in you. This is what namaste is, right? I bow to the me in you. I acknowledge that we share something. So that it's not so much, so it's just that spirit. I don't want to make too much of that. It's just, it reminds me of that same connection where you're not separated from someone, but we are the same. Yeah. Yeah, so there's a co-feeling that exists. Rather than you are suffering and I'm over here fixing your suffering. It's I'm sharing where you are and I desire to relieve your suffering. Okay.
I like how you talked about how there's a positive energy to it though, that it's not
right.
When you suffer as well.
Right. That's not helpful.
That, yeah.
Yeah. It's a fine line, and it's where equanimity comes in and joins compassion, where you don't get sucked in, but you maintain an equipoise, you know? You're sort of in balance with it. You're not blown away by it. And that's an important part of compassion, There has to be some energy for movement. Okay, so what I'd like to do to end the evening is to do a little loving kindness practice. So the way we do the practice is we choose some phrases, usually four phrases, and we repeat them over and over. And we start repeating them with ourselves. So, for example, we might say, "May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy." So we wish ourselves well. And the normal progression, what then happens is you go on to choose a benefactor. So after you've been saying these phrases to yourself for a while, then you choose a benefactor, someone who has done something for you that causes you to feel very well inclined toward this person. You offer the phrases to that person. And then you go to a friend. And then you move to a neutral person, you know, like the bagger in the grocery store, somebody you don't know that you're just neutral about. And then you go to an enemy. You don't start with the hardest enemy. You start with, you know, somebody you just don't like. And you wish them well. And so it's a practice of wishing people well. And it really has to do with the change in your heart that's engendered by wishing people well. That's the goal of loving kindness meditation. It's also a concentration practice because it's a focusing practice. So unlike mindfulness, where you watch what your mind is doing, you're watching your mind. In this case, you're focusing your mind because you're repeating these phrases over and over again. So it's sometimes a way of it's complementary to mindfulness, and it's sometimes a way of kind of calming yourself. If you find you're really kind of spacey, you can do a little loving kindness meditation and then move into mindfulness. Okay, so let's just practice it for a little bit. So if you'll take a comfortable position, and what we'll do is I'll say the phrase and you just repeat the phrase to yourself silently. And we'll just try this for a little while. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be free from harm. May I be free from suffering. May I be strong in spirit. May I be free from fear. May I be free from harm. May I be free from suffering. May I be strong in spirit. May I be free from fear. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be well. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be happy. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be well. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be happy. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May all beings be well. May all beings be peaceful and at ease. May all beings be happy. May the merits of this practice be for the benefit of all beings. May you all be happy. Thank you.